The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, a happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We have so much information to share today. Let me just go over some of the issues. Our guest in the second part of our program is Professor Martin Nowak, and we're going to talk about new insights into the role of cooperation in altruism, in evolutionary theory, and challenges to this whole idea that we have selfish genes. I don't believe we do, so we'll go after that. Then we have a lot to share in the way of issues. Ralph Nader, commentary, Waiting for the Spark. Obama's dirty energy fixation. As radioactivity levels continue to spike in Japan, Obama's support for nuclear power is unwavering. New information from Ed Brusk of the New York Times, a sugar bombshell. Well, let's take a look at what he has to say in his investigation, and then go up on GaryKnoll.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and read a really definitive scholarly piece on what's wrong with sugar. And you'll see, whoa, is the New York Times finally getting on board about 35 years late. Brand new information today. Last week I interviewed Greg Palast, filmed him, on this new special I'm doing, which will be done in about 3 weeks. Today, brand new information. British Petroleum secret deep water blowout. Oh yeah, I'm not talking about the one in the Gulf of Mexico. There was another one. Never heard about it? They lied before Congress? We'll tell you. Robert Scheer, the new corporate world order. And finally, secret memos exposing the link between oil firms and guess what? The invasion of Iraq, from Paul Bignell from The Independent. And I'm going to start with that one in our issue segment first. Time permitting, you can call in. We have a lot to share. I don't know that I'll get to all this stuff. But let me begin with the latest on health and healing. This morning on the overnight show we do on our sister station, on KPFK, I was addressing a person's question about inflammation in the body. And I realize most people don't understand that most illnesses are due to inflammation. And just being overweight in and of itself increases inflammation in the body. In fact, including to clinical science, I just looked it up, volume 107 from the University of Connecticut found that overweight people end up having a substantial reduction in levels of inflammatory biomarkers that you need, but you have an increase in inflammation, and that can promote hardening of the arteries. So the question is then, what do we need to look for? If you had a test, what would you look for? Well, you'd look for C-reactive protein, homocysteine, fibrinogen, interleukin-6, monocyte chemoattractant protein, tumor necrosis factor alpha. When you have these elevated in your body, though you can't feel it, is promoting disease. That disease could end up being a heart attack or cancer. There's a big connection between inflammation and chronic disease. There's been many articles published on this. There was one in the New England Journal of Medicine, volume 35, an article entitled Elevated Levels of Inflammatory Markers, Particularly C-Reactive Protein, Indicate an Increased Risk of Coronary Heart Disease. So what do we do about it? Well, first, get off all the fried food, the animal proteins, the soft drinks, the alcohol in any amount, and start eating what we talk about all the time, living foods, organic. Then there's certain nutrients that can make a difference in helping your body heal, turn off the inflammation. High up on the list are the omega-3 fatty acids. There's tons of studies out there, whether it's the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 63, from the University of Newcastle, showing that you can turn off inflammation with the omega-3 fatty acids. And you get the omega-3 fatty acids when you take flaxseed oil. But there are other superstars as well. That's high in DHA and EPA, and that's what you need. Pycnogenol, another very important anti-inflammatory nutrient, comes from the French maritime pine bark. And good information on that at 200 milligrams. The omega-3 generally at 1,500 to 2,000 milligrams. But also astaxanthin, vitamin C, vitamin D, folic acid, coenzyme Q10, resveratrol, chromium, L-carnitine. All of those are pro-turning off inflammation in the body. So if you're eating the anti-inflammatory green vegetables or the red fruits or the berries, then you're getting your pro-inflammatories. Now that's not all the nutrients, but certainly that's enough to get started on that could help you. Many times on this program, I've suggested that we need to spend more time with nature. There's only so much time that you should be around the buildings and the sidewalks for several reasons, not the least of which you pick up the energy of the people. Sometimes that energy is exciting and positive, like New York City has so much culture to choose from and so many people to share ideas and energy with. But then you walk down the streets, as I was just 2 days ago, and I'm looking at all the people sitting outside enjoying a lunch. And what if I brought someone from Spain, from San Sebastian, and walking down the many, many streets there, we have beautiful cobbled streets and gorgeous architecture, some of it 1,200 years old, small little restaurants, wonderfully prepared food. The same people having an enjoyable conversation, sharing company. And then if they were to take a look at what it's like on Amsterdam, on the Upper West Side, garbage piled high, smells, dirt, noise, grime, everything just looking ratty and broken down, what happens is we end up adapting to the environments that we're in. We adapt to the people around us. That's not always a good thing. So then you need a break from that. You need to go out, and if you live anywhere in America, I suggest all of you visit South Beach and one particular place on South Beach. It's called Lincoln Road. It's about 8 blocks long. There's no traffic on it, car traffic. And it's a green environment, but it's beautiful. Enormous variety of stores and music and theater, everything, restaurants. But the people are relaxed, and there's water and fountains and palm trees. It's clean. They come out every morning and soap it down and hose it off. I know because I've gone running up through there at times. And there's no other street like it in the United States. No, don't even begin to tell me, because I was just out to that near the wharf in L.A. No, that's really ghettoize now. So we don't get out of our environment, and we should. But think of the things you can do. In New York, you can go to the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens, the Bronx Botanical Gardens. Get in nature. It heals. Even if it's just walking to work and walking by some trees. When I used to work at WMCA, I would walk over 86th Street at that time where I lived in Broadway, and I'd walk to Central Park West and walk down the park. I loved walking down the park. I don't care what time of year it was. I just loved the park. Here's the latest study showing that those of you, like myself, who really enjoy nature, got that right. This is the University of Illinois College of Agriculture. Quote, green environments are essential for human health. Research shows that a walk in the park is more than just a nice way to spend an afternoon. It's an essential component for good health. Through the decades, park advocates, landscape architects, popular writers have consistently claimed that nature had healing powers. But according to the professor, quote, but until recently their claims haven't undergone rigorous scientific assessment. So they did this assessment and they found it was absolutely true. So give yourself a chance to be in nature. Next up, how does inflammation lead to something like cancer? Well, this is in Science Daily. This is a study from Ohio State University's Comprehensive Cancer Center. And what they show is that it is inflammation due to infection or conditions such as chronic inflammatory bowel disease that ups the risk of cancer substantially. Now, what are some things that can cause infection? Well, how about all the viruses and bacteria that we're exposed to, that we take for granted? How little time do you see people really being conscious about hygiene? In fact, if you're really concerned about hygiene, more often than not, you'll be mocked. Oh, you're not all that worried. Not worried, not paranoid, just cautious. Because if you're not cautious, you could pay a price. I remember once being on an airplane. I had a long flight. It was 12 hours. And three people right beside me were coughing up a storm the whole trip. Every seat was taken. There was no other place to be. But fortunately, I took a little ionizer, put it around my neck. That created a protective shield for about 12 inches around my face. And that trapped any viruses or bacteria, certainly diminishing them substantially. But then every hour, I simply sprayed a mixture that I'd made into my nose and mouth. And people thought it was strange who were sitting beside me. But anything that would have gone into my body would have been killed. All right? No, I didn't get sick. They were sick. And everyone else in the plane that didn't think about protecting themselves ended up having in their body the viruses and bacteria that came out of those sick people. What if they had tuberculosis, which they could have? Well, according to the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, that we don't end up dealing with inflammation as we should, and that can lead to cancer over a period of time. So once again, I mentioned get rid of the pro-inflammatory items in your diet. Hot dogs, hamburgers, pizzas, french fries, colas, alcohol. These are all pro-inflammatory. Then pay attention to basic hygiene. In your house, simply soak down a paper towel in alcohol and wipe off all the doorknobs to the refrigerator, to the sink, in the bathroom, surface areas. How simple is that? Do it a couple times a day. If you've got a family, children, do it a little more frequently. And if one person in the family has a cold or the flu, simply wear a mask. Have them wear a mask, you wear a mask, and then not everybody gets the cold and flu. And serve them with disposable utensils and paper plates and whatnot. It makes all the difference in the world. Throw away their toothbrush after they use it. Otherwise, they'll get a rebound infection. It's the simple things that protect you. And finally, there's a big problem right now going on in the Amazon because they're looking for gold. The poor are looking for gold, especially with gold now at $1,500. And what's happening is there's enormous deforestation in the Peruvian Amazon. In fact, it's increased 600% in just the last 2 years from small-scale miners. And they're driven by record gold prices. And they're destroying about 15,000 acres in just two little mining plots. So it doesn't take long for tens of thousands of people to think, oh, this is the way out. Let me get rich. And they go in there and just start ripping everything up, burning everything, and digging and that's unfortunate. Well, finally, one last thing. A lot of people don't know if canola oil is good or not good. Organic canola oil, according to Science Daily, the research done at South Dakota State University, protects you against colon cancer. Distinguished professor there in their Department of Pharmaceutical Sciences wrote an article on, quote, the chemo preventative effects of dietary canola oil on colon cancer development. It's published in Nutrition and Cancer. Quote, this is the first time anyone has done work on the effects of canola oil in animals on colon cancer prevention. Canola oil was able to reduce the incidence of colon cancer by over a third. There's other good things that canola oil, organic canola oil, can do. That's just one of them. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Back in a moment with our issues of the day.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have played, before they ask us to pay the bills, and while we still have the chance, let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon, humming a distant.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Three short pieces of insight. One of them will be our issue of the day. This is from Greg Pallast. Only 17 months before British Petroleum's Deepwater Horizon rig suffered a deadly blowout in the Gulf of Mexico, another British Petroleum Deepwater oil platform also blew out. You've heard and seen much about the Gulf disaster that killed 11 British Petroleum workers. If you've not heard about the earlier blowout, it's because British Petroleum has kept the full story under wraps. Nor did British Petroleum inform Congress or U.S. safety regulators, and along with its oil industry partners, have preferred to keep it that way. In early September 2008, British Petroleum's central Azeri platform in the Caspian Sea had a blowout. As one memo marked, quote, secret, puts it, given the explosive potential, British Petroleum was quite fortunate to have been able to evacuate everyone safely and to prevent any gas ignition, unquote. The Caspian oil platform was a spark away from exploding, but luck was with the 211 rig workers. It was eerily similar to the Gulf catastrophe, as it involved British Petroleum's controversial quick-set drilling cement. The question we have to ask, if British Petroleum had laid out the true and full facts to Congress and regulators about the earlier blowout, would those 11 Gulf workers be alive today and the Gulf Coast spared oil spill poisons? The bigger question is, why is there no clear law to require disclosure? If you bump into another car on the Los Angeles freeway, you have to report it. But there seems to be no clear requirement on corporations to report a disaster in which knowledge of it could save lives. So, and then they lied about it. So that's so much for British Petroleum. Now, while we're waiting for your calls, let's go into our studio in New York, where we have standing by Elizabeth and Joe. Hi, Elizabeth and Joe.
Hi. Hi, Gary.
How's it going, Gary?
It's always going well. And 1 year, this woman decides to buy her mother-in-law a cemetery plot as a Christmas gift. The next year, she didn't buy her gift. And when the mother-in-law asks, why didn't you buy me a gift? The woman says, well, you still haven't used the gift I gave you last year. And that's how the fight started.
Thank you.
What's on your end there, Elizabeth?
Okay. We got a letter in from Jameson. He says, I teach history and I really enjoy your historical perspectives. However, I have not heard you discuss the genocide in the Ukraine or the genocide in Armenia. He would like your perspective, and he'd like you to please address.
All right, well, I'll do short order to these, not definitive. I can't do both. It would take too much time. Let's just pick pick one.
Okay. The genocide in Armenia.
All right. Now, for the longest period of time, the Turks denied that there was any genocide, but indeed there was genocide. The figures range anywhere from 600,000 to 1.5 million. They were deported. Their homes and property were confiscated. They were denied any due process. They were herded up. It was very similar to how the Jews were treated by the Nazis in Poland, and even in the Ukraine. There was no way that they could protect themselves because they did not have worldwide advocates as such, and it was a massive slaughter over a period of years. This, now, I'll skip from there because I'm looking at the clock and we have a few minutes. I will go into that in greater depth. The massacre in the Ukraine was simply one that's almost not talked at all in the United States, and I believe that we should understand it. Are you familiar with Ukraine? Do you know where the Ukraine is?
Yes, sort of. I mean, it's the Soviet area.
Well, it used to be a part of the Soviet states. It's a pretty good-sized country. It was the breadbasket of Russia. It's bordered by Georgia, Moldova, Romania, Belarus, Poland, and Slovakia, and Hungary. And it's about twice the size of Belarus, right, and about almost twice the size of Poland. It's pretty, about the size of France, a little larger than France. It all started after the First World War. It started with what was called the February Revolution in 1917. That's when the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks and all the other Trotskyites, all the others, began to fight against the imperial court and imperial rule, and hence the Bolshevik Revolution. That's when this started. Then there was what was called the White War. The White War was where America and Britain and Germany, most of the countries fought in the First World War, fought this Second War, but it was called the Forgotten War because it was not called a war. And what it really was is divide up Russia. They've got these ragtag people there called the Reds, the Bolsheviks. They're not armed. They're not financed. We'll go in there, and one country wanted to take the timber, another the gold mines. They all looked at Russia as this just gigantic natural resources they could just take for themselves. And it lasted about 4 years. At the conclusion of this, around 1922, Russia took over the Ukraine. And in 1924, Stalin became the dictator. And it was then called the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And he put a group of people in charge, one of them over the Ukrainians. But the Ukrainians were extremely independent. There were a lot of Ukrainians who didn't like being told what to do. So there was always this animosity between the Ukrainians who didn't want to be a part of Russia and those that did. And so Stalin said no to a Ukrainian independent state. And so the first thing he did, he went in and he started getting rid of those people who were influencing the Ukrainians to a nationalist perspective. The Orthodox Christian leaders, 10,000 of them, were jailed or killed. Then they saw something that could help Russia. Russia needed arms, but they couldn't manufacture them. They didn't have the parts. They needed to build factories. They needed equipment, but they didn't have cash to buy it. So they then decided, we will give you grain in return, including the United States. In return, you give us what we need. And there were about 4,000 foreign experts working in the Ukraine at that time. So while Stalin needed foreign currency, he gave food, and that was his currency. At that time, almost all the farmers in the Ukraine were independent. They had their own independent farms. They managed them well. There was no starvation. There was self-sufficiency. And there was some swapping and trading of foods. And in came Stalin because he had been given some advice by his advisors that you can't have these people eating and growing foods we won't have any control over. Take away their capacity to grow food, and they got these rich farmlands. Take over their farmlands. So he started the whole process of collective farming. And he had 25,000 collective farms. And if you were called a kulak, that meant you were an independent farmer. That meant that you were self-sufficient. But that became an enemy. You were an enemy of the state if you were an independent farmer. And then in came all these red brigades, and they started recruiting the poor people. And they took all the poor people, and they said, take away these, these independent farms. So there's enormous amount of fighting and farms being burned down and people beaten. And then people no longer felt comfortable having their own independent farms, so they started joining the cooperatives under coercion. Now, you were to work all day. Even your children had to work. And the only way you could be fed is you would get rations. So for how much you produced, you would get a certain amount of food in return. But then the yields started getting higher, and he just started buying more armaments. So he then took away people's food. And at one point, he took away all the seeds and animals and equipment, confiscated everything. And if you didn't go along with it, you were deported to Siberia. Your punishment was 10 years in prison if you wanted to keep your own land and farm it. And then he began to farm out the lumber, the forest. Everything was being sold. And if you had to go and work in the forest, you generally lived 2 years. If you worked in the mines, you lived 2 to 3 years and you died. And finally, everybody was in the collective. And then in 1929, there was the farmers' protest. And everybody stopped working. Well, then that sent the production down. And they were protesting because if you worked a 14-hour day in Ukraine under Stalin, you were given 200 grams of wheat. That's 6 ounces of food for your whole body per day. And so then Stalin did something very smart. He wrote an article saying, you're right, we made a mistake, we shouldn't be doing it this way, we're going to do it differently. Anybody who wants to get back their land, anyone who wants to have their farm can have it all back. So everyone said, great, and they all celebrated. They went back and they all sowed their fields, and then he went in and confiscated everything. Every single thing you could confiscate in the Ukraine was confiscated. It was so bad that the OGPU, which is the Soviet secret police, went into your house to make sure you had no food at all. Nothing. You couldn't have seeds. You couldn't eat. You couldn't have a grain of corn. You could have nothing. And if you were found to have hidden anything, you were shot. And that caused another rebellion. But that was put down quickly. And then the big famines occurred. Now, the first people they went after was the intelligentsia: school teachers, lawyers, professors, priests, writers, medical doctors. They were all killed or put in prison. But then the food dropped precipitously by almost 50%. Then you had the 1931 food rebellion, and then you had the 1932 famine. And the famine was phenomenally severe. That's where the national liberation struggle started, in the spring of 1932. And there was at least a minimum of 6 million people who died, but some put the figure as close to 12 million who died. At any given time, at least 8 million people were starving to death, or at least one-fourth the Ukrainian population. And horses, animals, everything died, and then they reverted to cannibalism. There was not a village in the Ukraine that people were not eating dead corpses. They had no choice. In one family, they selected one of two daughters, killed the daughter, and ate her so the family could survive. Hard to imagine a part of history that no one likes to remember, especially those who are pro-Stalinist. How many people? That's just Ukraine. That was not a needed famine. The United States knew that it was taking food from the Ukraine. The United States White House and our State Department fully well knew that there was a famine that was intentional, because he wanted to break the back of any other groups that wanted to get their freedom. This is one big way to say, screw with us, you die. And so others pulled back. The other 12 nations that had been brought in to be collective parts of Russia then took a look at what went on in the Ukraine, this massive genocide. And they said, well, not now. And that's why it took all those years before they were finally free. God. Hope that answers your question.
Thank you so
much. I'll go
much.
Into greater depth on Armenia, but I don't have the time now. Thanks a lot. Joe, can we hold your question for tomorrow? Because I want to go to our guests now.
Yeah, of course, Gary.
Thank you. Let's say hello to, and I gave his background earlier in the show, Professor Martin Nowick. He is going to be sharing his insights today into the role of cooperation and altruism in evolutionary theory and the challenges to this whole notion that we have a selfish gene and therefore I have a right to be selfish. I can't help being selfish. It's in my gene. Really? Well, we'll talk with the Professor Nowick, of Professor of Biology and Mathematics at Harvard University and Director of the School's Program of Evolutionary Dynamics. And he's also the author of Super Cooperators. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello, it's great to be with you.
Thank you. There is a great deal being researched and written today on evolutionary processes, and even in brain science and neurocognitive studies, we're coming to the realization of altruism and even compassion's inherency in the human being. And I'd like to ask you a simple question. In light of the many challenges the world faces, many, if not most, can be deconstructed back to simple greed and selfishness and competition. What role do you see the new sense of understanding evolution, such as yours and other researchers, suggest playing in our ability to confront our global challenges constructively and with foresight and wisdom?
Wow, that's a complicated question that would require sort of a one-hour lecture, I think, as a proper answer. But maybe I could say that my role here at Harvard and in the scientific community is really to promote the use of mathematics in evolution. So in some sense, evolutionary biology, similar to physics some centuries ago, is undergoing this maturation process where the discipline is actually receiving a rigorous fundamental basis. So ideas that you have in evolution, you can describe in terms of mathematical equations. And mathematical descriptions of evolutionary processes give rigorous and new insights. And in this new book, Super Cooperators, that I wrote together with Roger Highfield, who is the New Scientist editor in London, we describe, first of all, that the process of evolution is based, as we always knew and know since Darwin, is primarily based on mutation and selection. Now, mutation means that new variants are being produced by erroneous reproduction. And selection means that these variants are in competition with each other, so mutants compete because they have different rates at which they reproduce. So these are the two fundamental ingredients of the evolutionary process, mutation and selection. And in this book I argue that there is a third, completely fundamental ingredient to evolution, or force of evolution, that is actually needed if you want to understand the life on Earth as it is surrounding us. And that is cooperation. And cooperation means that individuals, and they can be cells or animals or humans or plants, would actually help each other. Cooperation means that I pay a cost for somebody else to receive a benefit. And the fascinating question that arises immediately is, why would I do this? Why would I help somebody who is a competitor in the Darwinian struggle for survival? And this is what we discuss in this book, how natural selection can actually give rise to cooperation and why cooperation is sometimes a winning strategy.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you. Let's talk, if you would please, about the prisoner's dilemma and the roles of reward and punishment in particular. And then, if you would, could you relate this to a particular serious or urgent situation we collectively face today that requires deep cooperation between people or even nations, such as climate change or global agricultural erosion or food shortages, which affects millions of people in the future detrimentally. And also, this morning I mentioned that where I absolutely support collective bargaining for the teachers in Wisconsin, I was disappointed that they didn't use that moment of public attention crystallizing on an important social issue to broaden the argument to say, why can we not now go from protecting our rights under collective bargaining to protecting the rights of homeowners from foreclosure, or to protect the rights of children not to go to bed hungry each night or to go to school with an empty stomach in the morning, and to broaden it out so that we could do more than just something that was individually important to us, but would those same 120,000 people been in the streets if it was demonstrating for something that was important in a cooperative way for another cause and other people? Your thoughts, please.
So the prisoner's dilemma is a game, or is a simple metaphor that describes the problem of cooperation and defection. And game here is used in the sense of game theory, which is a field of mathematics that was invented by the Hungarian mathematical genius John von Neumann and the Austrian economist Oskar Morgenstern, collaborating in Princeton just after the war. They came up with a mathematical description for how people face economic and strategic decisions. And in this mathematical approach, which is widely used these days in economics, but has also transcended into biology and is extremely successful to describe evolution in biology, one aspect of this game theory is the so-called prisoner's dilemma. And the prisoner's dilemma was not invented by von Neumann and Morgenstern, but came later. It was invented at the Rand Foundation in California in the 50s. And it's the following situation. There are two people, and they are conjectured to have committed a crime, and the police has them in custody in different cells. And they offer now each one of them a deal, and the deal would be confess, you become the witness of the prosecution, and you will receive a reduced sentence. But your partner will receive an increased sentence. So they are now faced with this dilemma. Should they confess and work with the police, which means defect on their partner, or should they remain silent and thereby cooperate with their partner? And the situation that is presented to them has the following ranking of the values, of the payoff values that they have to consider. So the best outcome would be if they would both cooperate with each other, if they would remain silent, because then nothing can be proven. And then they would have only a very short prison sentence, but they would get a longer prison sentence if they would both actually confess what they have done. But in any situation, if the other person cooperates, and one person defects and the other person cooperates, then the defector has the highest payoff and the cooperator has the lowest payoff of the game. So the prisoner's dilemma is a situation where it would be better if both people cooperate, but there's always an incentive to defect. So more generally, the prisoner's dilemma describes a situation where you could pay a cost for somebody else to get a benefit. And if we both have this choice, then it would be ideal if we both help each other. But there is the incentive that I just let you help me, but I don't help you. And that is the prisoner's dilemma. So the incentive is to defect, but if both come to the conclusion to defect, then both are worse off had they cooperated. And the prisoner's dilemma is formulated between two people, but it can be extended as a game between many people. And if many people at the same time are asked this choice of cooperation and defection, then it is called a public goods game. And in a public goods game, people can either contribute to the public good at a cost to themselves, but then everybody has a benefit, or they can free ride on the cooperation of others. And the question is, how can one envisage mechanism that leads to the evolution of cooperation in the prisoner's dilemma or in the public goods game?
I would like, if you don't mind, to ask you a question that may seem existential, but it's very pragmatic. I'd like to extend your thought and throw in a different concept, and it is this. Right now, I believe that our need to believe in the certainty of power structures, whether it's a Department of Defense or a Republican Party or Democratic Party, it suspends our need for critical judgment. In other words, as long as I feel good about what I'm believing in, and as long as you've convinced me that you're going to do right by me, then my power to make my own independent mind up no longer is mine. The consequences of me giving me my power to you is that I will not look at the results of how you use it. I'll only listen to what you tell me you're going to do. I'll never look at the truth of it. Like, we're going to war in Iraq because freedom and getting rid of this tyrant and weapons of mass destruction. Well, today, I just read on my program today from the Independent in England that secret documents showed that it was about oil and how they were cutting deals with oil companies. Now, knowing that we were betrayed as a government, as individuals, by companies, do we have the capacity to then pull back the energy and the commitment we have given institutions, governments, corporations, so we can then at least be independent enough to make a judgment about what we've been doing wrong? And then I apply that to medicine and everything else, the media, all the media's objective. I saw it in the New York Times, must be true. I read it on, I must be true. I just think we have become so much prisoners of conformity and consensus and lacking that critical ability to separate ourselves from the institutions that control so much of our lives. Your thoughts, please.
So the interaction between individuals can be described as a problem of cooperation and defection, where people need to trust each other to find a common ground. And the same is actually true for conflicts between countries. So countries are also often described by game theoretic scenarios, by prisoner's dilemma-like situations where they can either help each other or they can start to defect on each other, they can withdraw help, they can manipulate each other. And it's very interesting how democracies come actually to political consensus, and as you say, we actually rely on the accuracy of the information that we receive from the media. And this is extremely important to form our political opinion. And if you are, so this kind of trust is something that is extremely important for human interactions. And one way how we see this in evolutionary game theory is in indirect reciprocity. So an indirect reciprocity situation is that I help somebody and this gives me the reputation of a helpful person, and then others will help me. And what we observed is that people are obsessed with finding out about the reputations of others, either people or companies or governments, and that we have a very strong drive to understand who is doing what to whom and why. And this is an aspect of our social intelligence. And this process of forming an opinion can be manipulated. And this is where the situation becomes more problematic.
But look at all the people who have betrayed us. All the presidents have betrayed us. They've lied to us. You know, President Johnson about the Gulf of Tonkin that got us into the Vietnam War. There are over 3.5 million people on all sides who died in that war. No one has ever apologized. The Bush and his whole administration, now we find out today that the British also knew, they got us in this war. Think of the suffering. No one apologized. No one goes to jail. No one's reputation is destroyed. And also, I just finished doing research that showed that Wall Street firms, all of them, pharmaceutical firms, all of them, have engaged in hundreds of thousands of illegal acts for which they have been charged, found guilty, and paid fines, yet not one single reputation has been destroyed. Not one millimeter of credibility have they lost. What does that tell us when people have done such heinous acts and yet we continue to support them as if they were perfect?
I mean, this is somehow outside my own expertise, but if it is correct or partly correct what you say, then it suggests that these companies or interest groups have very strong lobbyists, which create a good reputation for them despite the actions that would actually lead to a reduced reputation.
Isn't it interesting that that which is a natural part of us, the desire to cooperate, the desire to share, the desire to care and nurture, is frequently used against us as if it were weakness by those who see our vulnerabilities?
What we see in our studies is that cooperation is the best outcome for everybody, but cooperation is always vulnerable to exploitation. So what I find in my research and what I describe in this book, there is no cooperative utopia. We all strive for cooperation, but it is always vulnerable to exploitation, and it will always break down after some time. So we observe these cycles of cooperation and defection. And how much cooperation you have overall depends on how long you can maintain a cooperative state and how quickly you can rebuild a cooperative state after you have destroyed it.
Wonderful insights. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best. This is a very important work, Super Cooperators, Altruism, Evolution, and Why We Need Each Other to Succeed, by Professor Martin Nowak at Harvard. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you so much. Good to talk.
I'm Gary Nall. We're coming up to the end of our program. I understand I'm not in New York. I'm filming right now all day and all night trying to get some very important people who've got information we didn't know about. Can't go into it. This is very powerful stuff. So I got to be really discreet. In any case, for those of you who called in, and I was told by my engineer we were flooded, tomorrow, call back in, please, and address your issues, and we'll get you on the air tomorrow. Okay? We have a wonderful program scheduled for Earth Day. Have a nice day, everyone. Thank you very much for listening.
Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.